open a work session on Senate Bill 722. I believe we left that, colleagues. We adopted the Dash 13. We adopted the A8, A9. I think the only thing we have left to do is adopt the A14.
Mr. Chairman? I understand that the A14s are the ones that remove the option.
That's correct.
I move the A14 amendment.
And we also adopted the A12. We have a motion, colleagues, to adopt the A14 amendment to Senate Bill 722. Any discussion? Seeing none, to order. Mr. Mack?
I move that we send the bill to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Okay, Representative Mannix, I believe we need to reinsert the amendments we adopted previously, the 12, 9, 8, and 13.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion. I assume that's just to make sure that they're all being blended together so that they're all copacetic and that they're not inconsistent. All right, I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
A motion for us, colleagues, to reinsert into the bill due to our previous reconsideration. We do that, the dash 8, dash 9, the dash 12, and the dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 722. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I now move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues have a motion to move Senate Bill 722 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes. This is with the Dash 14 amendment.
Yes.
I will be voting no and serving notice on minority report.
Okay. Representative Starr?
I don't think it should be much of a surprise. I can be concerned about this bill. Concerned about the A14 amendments, but in deference to the chair, I'll support the motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mack?
It's no secret that I've supported the removal of the opt-out and also the removal of the third tier. I see this as a compromise at this stage because I don't want to see us lose 722, and I will be supporting the motion that I happen to make myself.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I know this is very much a compromised position. I have supported both the opt-out and the third tier, and we will be removing the opt-out with the A14. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, we need to talk about vote. I just want to vote.
Okay. Call the roll.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
No, I'm sure not as well possible. I'm not worried about that.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse.
Representative Gardner?
Excuse.
Representative Maddox?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 722 goes to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. And I guess I can you want to carry that?
You better.
I'll be the carrier. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 722. Who joins in your minority report?
It could be either.
Neither of them are here to give notice. I could adjourn the meeting now. And
well, no, because they had not given notice. Only one has given notice. As long as they were on the line to the other side.
Okay.
Did you put any numbers in that mark?
We did.
I'll let you see this in the morning.
8, 9, 12, and 13.
Okay.
And the 14.
8, 9.
We have conflict amendments.
They're getting back. Take a ride. They're getting back.
That's
all right. Let me get Edward. He's probably up next door.
Gardner's around somewhere. What we will do while we're searching for some more members, we will open a work session on let's go to Senate Bill 1331. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1331. Senator Hand, that's come up. Can you give us an overview of this? Are you doing this?
Yeah,
Give us an overview, if you would, Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1331, AM Growth, increases benefit limitations for group health insurance policies coverage, mental or nervous conditions, and chemical dependency by 25% from current limits, and creates an interim task force for mental health parity.
All righty. Gentlemen, thank you for coming this evening. I appreciate your indulgence. I know we all get to work a lot of long hours this time of the session, and this is another evening. Thank you for coming. Introduce yourselves for the record and jump right in.
For the record, my name is Len Hammond, State Senator, District 26.
I'm Gene Dufler, District 16. I can't talk.
What a blessing that is for a majority leader. I'm Senator Vern Duncan, District number 12.
Mr. Chair, members, the reason that Senate Bill 1331 is here before you is a bill that I have been involved with, and I started out with a different bill early on in the session that would have moved the state of Oregon towards full parity on mental health benefits and drug and alcohol treatment. The Senate Majority Leader, Senator Durfler, said, why don't we try to join forces, work together, and find a compromise that we can both agree to support. And with that effort and his generosity, we reintroduced the bill that you now have before you in the form of Senate Bill 1331. This is a bill that we created mental health coverage in the statute in 1987. Since 1987, there has been no increase in the benefit level. And what this bill attempts to do is put a modest increase of 25% in place. If you really use the inflation rate over that 12-year period, it should have probably been a 60 or 75% increase. But we tried to use a very modest and deliberate approach into saying, let's fund it with a modest increase, and then let's go to an interim task force and look at how we should proceed to the next level. Should we pursue the issue of full parity? If we should, when and how? Do we define what mental health is? Do we define that there are certain limitations placed upon it that may not be renewed time after time after time without success or completion? These are all questions that need to be answered by the task force. And I believe, quite frankly, as an insurance agent who deals in health and life, that we can find reasonable solutions to proceed on this in a reasonable manner. For that reason, Mr. Chair, members, I would certainly be happy to answer any questions you might have. And I would respectfully request that we might be able to expedite this bill on its passage. There is one other thing I would like to add. The delta balance that Senator Durfler and I made in the Senate with our colleagues was predicated upon the opponents and the proponents not coming to the House and subjecting the bill to amendment. There are those people who would like to see an amendment added, perhaps, as a means of in effect showing the bill for the transaction, the Senate amended. And I would respectfully request that we've been down that path once before, and we reintroduced another bill, but I'd respectfully request that we resist that temptation.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to be able to talk very much. Senator Hammond and I have worked on this bill, and as he mentioned, there's a lot of questions that we need answered before we can probably move forward. I'm very fond of this measure. Certainly, I don't think any of us disagree that mental health treatment is just as important as any physical treatment. The problems that I foresaw, and Senator Hammond wishes to work with me on, is that I have to be very careful about how we raise costs for health care. And as you raise costs, you lose people that are being covered. And Oregon's done a great job of covering people. I think we're probably one of the better ones in the nation. We reduced the number of people who don't have insurance down to about 11% of state. That's quite a good record. I think this modest increase that we're asking for, in my opinion, will raise the cost of insurance to probably about 1%. But if we can get involved in mental health, I don't think Senator Hammond said right, we haven't had a raise since 1987, so it probably is very appropriate to do that. So at any rate, I hope you will seriously consider this bill and to get through the system for us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to add my support to the bill, and I'm certainly appreciative of the work the majority leader has ahead and done in this bill. My constituents in my county have been very, very interested in this process, and I've had a chance to spend a great deal of time with them, busy with them, with the parents, and I tell you, it's a devastating kind of thing that hits the family. And I think as you look at the concerns of health, this is certainly a health problem, and those people do need some assistance. And as the majority leader said, it's a modest increase, but yet it's going to be some help. Now, I know a lot of people who would like to have a lot more, but we recognize the timing, we recognize the fiscal situation and all of those factors. And at this point, I think it's a modest kind of request, and I certainly would encourage the support of this committee, and would love to see the House pass it, because it's a good bill passed in the Senate, I think, in
substantial
margin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to state my support for the bill and apologize to the three senators for us being out of the room and in the room so many times. But the senators are for, and the other two senators know, sometimes the minority has to work hard to stay up with the majority.
Thank you. Other than that.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your being here this evening. As I understand the testimony, we will have to make a decision whether or not to swallow the whole enchilada or not swallow it at all based on the delicate balance of the pieces that come over from the Senate.
That's the agreement that we reached on the Senate side, and we understand we don't like to impose conditions upon the House. But
I think there was a firearms bill that came to you today that came along the same sort of line, so I'm not in a very good position to complain about up or down alternatives. I apologize, I interrupted you, Senator.
No, that's fine. You can interrupt as much as you want. So, but I think it's one of those things that you certainly have been aware of it, and I've been aware of it. There are certain conditions you have to accept in this place. If I had my brothers, I'd go to full parity within 2 or 3 years. But it isn't going to happen. And Senator Durfer said that it was going to happen over his dead body, and he's not dead yet, so he's still here.
I found out he was in the hospital a short time ago.
Yeah,
he's
back. He gives me a rush and he mounts too fast. But he's here. But I respect his counsel and advice, and we're trying to work together on this.
Other questions?
Thank you. I suppose the tension point is conducting the study at the same time that we're going ahead and increasing the benefit level. And I take it from your testimony that your point on that is that the benefit level hasn't been increased since I heard 1987?
Correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
You.
Over there. I think it was agreement
no one was going to talk about it. So,
is there anything else? We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1331.
Let me check real quick just outside the door.
Okay.
Because now we may go to some questions.
I wasn't here when you went. Did you even tell me we're on the ground there?
Did you
end the work session? We're out of work session. I didn't ask for it. The Senate of the Senior Saints today, no one was going to testify.
Okay.
Let's go and reconsider our vote on 369. We have conflict, and then it's solid. They should be in front of you. And if you ask that we pull it back in, stuff in these conflict amendments, and we can hopefully be done with it.
All right. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Maddox?
Well, perhaps Representative Devlin wanted to do it.
Oh. Representative Devlin?
Yes, ma'am.
Pardon, Mr. Chairman.
The only two of us are good. Mr. Chairman, could I have legislative council come forward?
Yes.
Should we end the rules first? We'll bring it back
first. Well, yeah, we'll talk about it.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 369.
This is just a simple question. The conflict amendment with respect to the changes in the all incorporated into this in the dash. There's nothing in these conflict amendments other than the conflict amendments that were necessary, right?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ted Reutling from the Legislative Council's office, tempted as we might sometimes be, no. The only thing that's in here are conflict amendments that are necessary to conform. In most cases, the language about the elimination of the presidential preference primary election in March to other bills that have moved through the process, and that's what the conflict amendments do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
They didn't ask for anything.
I know, Mr. Chairman, but at this stage,
we request it
and assuredly, there's nothing in these bills. I'm just kidding. There's nothing in this bill about contract workers.
Well, don't you trust me? Are you impugning members of this committee?
No, I'm not, Mr. Chairman. I'm
just asking questions.
I'm just asking questions because obviously it's a fair document, Mike. And thanks for the comments from the Legislative Council. I'm prepared to suspend the rules and those are so on.
It's not quite as thick as it was last time we had it before, however. The conflict, we moved a few pages and everything got consolidated together. So you make the motion then?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules.
For purposes of
reconsidering the motion by which we passed it before, okay. with the due pass recommendation.
Your motion, colleagues, to suspend the rules for purposes of reconsidering the vote by which we passed to the floor Senate Bill 369. Any objections?
Yes.
Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I
know. The rules are suspended now. And we have to reconsider the vote.
Move for reconsideration.
Move for reconsideration.
Representative Devlin moves for reconsideration of the vote by which we passed to the floor Senate Bill 369. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move that in the amendment to the commission. Or no, this should be a forward question.
Okay, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I move the 369-5 amendments into SB 369.
Because of motion to move the -5 amendments in the Senate Bill 369, is there any discussion? Representative Maddox.
I thought there was an independent contractor for this 53, but I don't
know. Must have moved Stepper into the board about page 42.
Any further discussion? You don't want to leave the show.
No.
Okay. Hearing no other, is there any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. The amendments are adopted in Senate Bill 369.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 369 as amended to the floor with the DuPont's recommendation.
Thank you very much, Representative Devlin. Your colleagues have a motion to move Senate Bill 369 as amended by the Dash 5 amendments to the floor with the DuPont's recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, to order. Representative Devlin, you're still the carrier?
Yes.
Okay. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 369. For there are individuals in the audience who wish to testify on Senate Bill 1331. No hands. We will then not go back there.
We're going to do SGR 6 tonight, Mr. Chairman.
That can work on House Bill 3615 next, if you can.
Very few people. Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, it's back in our possession now.
Oh, no. It didn't have the corner, of course. They couldn't move it.
Which one?
Wasn't that what happened at the end of the session?
Never got moved back.
Never. We never had a quorum on the floor. Or did it get? There was some question about that at the end.
Which one?
1168.
It might have got moved back from the floor.
It really doesn't matter if we don't have it.
Yeah.
Okay. Doesn't Hill around. This is his baby.
Members of the Public Utility Commission as the chairperson. It also specifies that the chairperson is the administrative head of the commission with the authority to hire, assign, reassign, and coordinate the personnel of the commission. The other section of the bill requires the governor to appoint an interim task force to study the structure of the commission and determine whether changes to the structure are advisable. If you have at your place the -A5 amendments, those are at the request of Representative Hill, and they specify that to appoint and employ officers and employees, the chairperson requires the consent of one other commissioner, and that the activities are also subject to the state personnel relations.
Do you have any testimony on this bill? We had Representative Hill in here last night, didn't quite get to it, and the amendments had some problems with the senior community.
Yeah.
There he is.
Representative Hill, right on cue.
Mm-hmm. His bag of tricks, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome, both of them.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Jim Hill, District 5, Hillsborough. Colleagues, what you have before you is House Bill 3615. We looked down the Ways and Means, came back with some issues. Senator Dukes in the Senate had some concerns about the change in the policy of the chairperson having the full power to hire and fire and at will decision, and that was not the intent that we were looking for. And so we have brought it the bill here to the House Rules Committee and offer the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3615, which clarify that the chairperson, in terms of that, must have the consent of one more member of the PUC in order to appoint, employ any of the employees at the PUC. So in terms of the chairperson cannot make any sweeping changes in terms of personnel or staff at the commission, but this change is purely for the purpose of putting one person in administrative control of an agency, being responsible so that we as legislators have someone to look to and ask questions of from an administrative perspective in terms of how that agency works. I think it's important to understand that there is no other branch of government. We have three. We've got the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branch. There is no special relationship that we've developed for the PUC. The PUC is in the executive branch and reports up to the governor. Now, people may not like that concept, but that is reality. That's how our system works, and it is important that we live through that process. I may not agree with decisions that are made at the PUC. I may not agree with decisions that the governor may make in appointments, but we have a process in which we work through those issues. This works to clarify and, I think, enhance in terms of the ability to manage an agency of the state of Oregon in terms of it will have no substantial effect in terms of the policy of the positions that PUC commissioners may make. In terms of their policy decisions and how they come to reach those decisions are clear in statute. We're not making any of those changes. I would urge the committee's adoption of the dash 5 amendments.
Thank you very much. Discussion, Driftman Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hill, wasn't the Public Utility Commission formed as a bipartisan commission coming out of a ballot initiative passed by the people?
I believe it was 1985, in that range. I'm not sure the exact year. There was an initiative petition, I think, which Oscar was the lead on, in terms of which changed the structure of the commission from a single administrator to a three-person commission. And there is a requirement in statute that one of the members of the that no more than two members of the commission can be from the same political party. So that so currently there are two Democrats on the commission and one Republican.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to continue, that was passed by the people as a nonpartisan, independent commission. And wouldn't this put the governor, no matter what political party is, interfering with that and not within the intent of the 86 initiative that was passed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I think in terms of the requirement in the statutes today that specify which party a person can belong to is on its face political. And that is why we have a Democratic governor and there are two Democratic members. And I would suspect that if the voters of the state of Oregon wanted to elect a Republican governor, that and the terms of the members of the PUC came up in his tenure or her tenure, that it would swing, that the members would then swing to the other side. Now, the decisions are policy decisions. These are not political decisions. And in terms of, I don't think in terms of asking for accountability in the management of the commission in, as an agency of the state of Oregon is somehow going to be viewed as political. I think in terms of it is
highly suspect in terms of, because I'm well aware that, Commissioner Ekus does not like these amendments. In terms, and he is out talking to people, telling them that, he doesn't like them. And I can't do anything about that. I sat down with the governor, staff, and we worked this out. It was the governor's concept to change this model in terms to the model which is used at the Employment Relations Board, and that is the structure that we have chosen here in terms of to, and I think it will bring accountability to the administrative aspects of the PUC. It will in no way affect the policy because the commissioners will make the same decisions as they do today.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, just a couple questions. Jim, could you just briefly describe the relationship between the staff and the commissioners? And how do they function relative to the commissioners?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't know.
Okay.
In terms of, I would imagine in terms of there is probably just like anyone in terms of a management and worker relationship. In terms of their assigned tasks to do, they work in different, and they're in different groups that have expertise in terms of telecommunications or gas or electric. In terms of, I would imagine in terms of that would continue. But we have made specific changes this legislative session in terms of that may or may not warrant structural changes in terms of management from an administrative standpoint in terms of how to do that. That's not to suggest that they could not be done in the present structure. I would suggest that it may be more efficient, and we as legislators can ask for accountability in the structure, and the governor can and ask for accountability in terms of from an administrative standpoint in the operation of the CUC.
You have a question?
Just go ahead, one. Again, this is also new territory, but what... I mean, just generally, do you know that what prompted the initiative? I mean, we used to have a single commissioner. What was it that somehow drove a decision by the people for this? I don't know in the history of this. I guess I'm here the first time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I think in terms of the driving impetus for changing from a single member, a single commissioner to a multiple commissioner was perceived or real abuse. In terms of, I don't know the history of the commission back beyond the current structure. But as I understand the history of the commission, that was the impetus, and I don't feel that this administrative structure change changes in any way the intent of the voters on determining that the commission needed to be three members, but it remains three members.
Thank you.
Further discussion, colleagues? Okay. Round up next.
Mr. Chair? Yes. I have a question for Dash. It's late Friday. I just want to make sure I understand the Dash 5 amendment. It does strike line 13 through 20, correct? Is that right? So that.
Yes.
But it does reinstate the idea that the governor shall serve as the chairperson at the pleasure of the governor. That is the chair who is still appointed by the governor, is that correct?
Yeah.
And that, again, I'm sorry, a little slow tonight. Does that mean it's new? That's basically new or old language.
Okay.
From current statute.
The governor appointing the chair is new language from current, not in current statute. The governor currently appoints the three commissioners with confirmation by the Senate, but the three commissioners select the chair on the current law.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Meyer.
I move that A5 amendment from the House Bill 615.
Calls of the motion for us to move the A5 amendment into 6:15, any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Matt?
I apologize, I was out of the room. Is this something that's been compromised and worked out, or is this simply just another shot at it?
Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix. This is work established with the governor's office. The structure is what the governor wants, and I think it's appropriate.
May I follow up?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
But this has not been worked out with the Public Utility Commission.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I did not.
You're not the ones who have to sign the bill. I understand. Thank you.
All questions are answered then. The motion for us to move the A5 amendment into Senate House Bill 3615. Any further discussion? Any objection?
I ask that you call the roll, please.
Okay. Kevin?
Representative Byers?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Excuse.
Pearson?
Aye. House Bill 3615, as amended by the A5 amendment, goes to the floor of the House.
Sure, maybe you should make that motion first.
Well, it's just the better. Okay, it is late. Representative Byers, move that the bill goes to the floor of the DPAC recommendation.
I move House Bill 3615, as amended, goes to the floor of the DPAC recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion before us, and colleagues, move the bill to the floor of the DPAC recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
Thank you. I'm undecided about my position on this bill. I was prepared to give a courtesy vote on the amendments, and I'd, if necessary, I'll certainly give a courtesy vote on the bill. But be that as it may, I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you very much. Any other comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe this is kind of affecting the independent nature of the PUC that was passed through a ballot initiative in 1986, and I'll be voting against it today for that reason.
Thank you. Can we call the roll, Kevin?
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
No. Serve notice of the possible minority report.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
No. Serve notice of possible minority report.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Excuse.
Harrison?
Aye. And the bill goes before the House to be passed recommendation. Is the bill going to the carrier?
Mr. Chairman, if I could be recognized for a moment.
Yes.
I'm joining with my colleague, Representative Gardner. He will be carrying the minority report. I'm doing that as a courtesy to him and voting no at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we will close the work session on the bill goes before the DPAC recommendation. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3615. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 1333. More give us an overview, would you?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1333A and Gross prohibits a government unit to change the method of appropriating the cost of public improvement among benefit properties from the method that was used at the time of the estimate assessment unless the change methodology is agreed upon by the owners and benefits from the property of the government unit finds that the change is necessary to achieve substantial public interest to avoid essentially inequities and establishes retroactively dates for assessments on benefited properties prior to January 1, 1985, and after that effective date of the measure.
Okay. Mr.
Honeycutt?
Mr.
Chair, Simmons, member of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Means and Action, speaking in support of Senate Bill 1333A. Senate Bill 1333A deals with local improvement districts. A local improvement district, an easy way to describe it is using a roadway analogy. Let's say a group of four neighbors decide that live on a gravel road and they decide that they want to pave the road in front of their houses. They can, if the local government chooses not to expend the money to pave that road, they can form a local improvement district amongst themselves
with the assistance of the local government to make those street improvements and to make that paving. And when they do that, the local government will do two things for them. They will first determine an estimate of the total project cost of paving that street. That's number one. The second thing they will do is apportion, spread the payments amongst the landowners within the district so that, in my example, if there are four landowners within the LID, they may each pay 25% of the total project cost. What 1333, once those costs are determined, the total project cost and each person's spread of the payments of those costs, the landowners then have the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to be in the LID. And if they choose not to be in the LID, then if enough of them choose not to be in the LID, then the LID dies and it's not formed and nobody has to spend their money. But basically, when they decide at that point, they know what the total project costs are, and they know, or at least estimate of the total project costs, and they know what their percentage is going to be, and they can make an economic decision based on those total project costs and the percentage allocated specifically to them. They've essentially, at that point, we believe, have a contract. And I don't believe that the city informs, or the local government informs folks at those times, at that time, that things might change in the future. The landowner should be entitled to rely on the benefit of the bargain they've made at that time without worrying about changes in the future. Unfortunately, under the current law, that's not the case. What Senate Bill 1333 does is it prohibits a local government from going in and changing the spread of the assessment. In my example, each person would be paying 25% of the total project cost. The bill would prohibit the local government from changing the spread of those assessments unless they do one or two things. And this is on lines 8 and 9 of the bill. Unless all of the landowners within the district agree to change the spread. So if the four landowners in my example were each paying 25% of the total project cost, if all of those four landowners agreed to change that spread so that one person would be paying 10% and another would be paying, let's say, 40, for example, and if they all agreed to change, then that would be allowable or acceptable. Alternatively, the local government can change that spread after the fact, but only if, they find that there's a substantial public interest in changing that assessment, or they want to avoid a substantial inequity. And the problem for the landowner, once you choose initially to be in the LID, once you agree and you make that decision based on what the local government tells you your percentage of the total project costs are going to be, you can't back out. So at some point, either 1 year down the road or 10 years down the road or what have you, the local government all of a sudden changes the percentage that you're required to pay. There isn't any way for you to back out of that deal. And the entire basis for your economic decision would then be wiped out. You may not have agreed to participate in the LID in the local improvement district had you known that instead of paying 10% of the total project cost, you are going to pay 40%, for example. And what this bill doesn't prohibit local government from changing from your assessment, let's say, from 10 to 40. But it requires them, if they're going to do that, to make the showing under either subsection 1 or 2 on lines 8 through 11 of the bill. The opposition to this bill comes from section 2, that's lines 12 through 14 of the bill. In section 2, provides that this bill will apply to LIDs formed prior to 1984. I believe there is only one current LID that was formed prior to 1984, and that is that occurs in the city of Tigard. I don't want to get into the facts of that city of Tigard case unless there are some questions from the committee. I believe the opposition that you'll hear, if you'll hear any opposition, is that this bill would be retroactive to that case. What happened very briefly in that case is in 1998, 14 years after the LID was formed, the assessments, there were four landowners within this LID. One landowner share of the total project cost went from 27% to 44%, an increase of $750,000. With the subsequent decision to pay in full in 30 days or pay foreclosure. It's ironic that the argument, I believe the argument that you'll hear is that the legislature shouldn't be acting retroactively, and remember what this case or what this bill does. It requires a city to make a showing that there's a substantial public interest for doing what they're doing. This won't end any litigation. It may require the city of Hydron in that particular case to go back and make a showing that there was a substantial public interest for doing what they did. But we, if it's good public policy in the future, it should be good public policy in that particular situation in 1998 as well.
Mr.
Chairman,
I need to jump in at that point. Several times in my practice as a lawyer, I've had cases where I thought an injustice, quote unquote, was done by a particular ruling, and yet, generally, as I've brought legislation to correct those laws, I've made a point of not making the legislation retroactive. In fact, I had a bill this session, 3055, that dealt with the reinstatement for injured workers because I had a case that I thought was erroneously handled by the Supreme Court, but I made a point of not making the bill retroactive, but only prospective, saying, if that's the rule of law, I'll deal with that case on the basis of the law as it was interpreted for that case, and let's fix the law for the future. Now, I will have to say, too, though, that in 1995, when we did a comprehensive reform of workers' comp laws, because there were a lot of claims pending and there was a lot of confusion, we did make some of those laws in effect retroactive because they dealt with current processing of claims and we needed some clarification. But what concerns me here is the idea that we're going back, making something specifically retroactive in a very narrow way that apparently affects only one case, which I understand is still in litigation. And it would seem to me that in that kind of situation, the merits of the case really shouldn't drive us on the policy as in terms of retroactivity, that we should focus on what the policy ought to be for the future. What's your response to that?
Chair Simmons, Representative Mannix, let me make 2 points. In the first case, in the first instance, this bill, if passed, will not overturn or will not determine the final outcome of that particular piece of litigation.
Just change the rules of the game.
What we'll be requiring is that the city in that particular case go back and adopt findings, the city council showing why there was a substantial public interest. That's point number one. And I believe, and if they can do that, then so be it. Point number two, and I think a point that's even more important, in that particular case, or in any case that this bill would affect, what you have is a landowner or landowners basing their determination of whether or not to participate in an LID, because the decision to participate is typically voluntary unless there are a sufficient number of landowners that want to participate in the LID to overrule your objection. You have a determination, an essentially voluntary determination made in that particular case in 1984. And in 1998, 14 years later, and it wouldn't matter whether it was 14 years later or one day later or what have you, at a time when you could no longer, the landlord could no longer be in or make the decision to opt out of the LID, you have the local government retroactively changing the spread of the assessments and applying that retroactively essentially back to 1984.
In fact, I would think that you would have an extraordinarily good legal case. You know, there would be some implicit contracts, and I think it led into this, perhaps even explicit contracts about the terms of the agreement that was reached, if it was a voluntary agreement. I think it would be a wonderful case to litigate.
As Chair Simmons, Representative Mannix, I would agree with you. There are, however, it does appear that there are provisions in Chapter 223 that expressly authorize a local government to do that. And what I'd refer you to 223.415, which allows the local government to adopt a different plan of apportioning benefits when its judgment is essential to secure an equitable assessment. That's the statutory language. So the legislature has already authorized that, and we are not trying to take away a local government's authority to do so. We simply want to essentially raise the hurdle and make them show that not only would the that the reason for changing those assessments when everybody has made their economic decision based on an earlier assessment is for some substantial public interest.
Thank you.
This is Ed. Can you follow on that last point? Could you just describe for the record what is the hurdles that you're creating with both the substantial public interest? What does that define that? And then the other is, or to avoid a substantial inequity?
Chair Simmons, Representative Edwards, we worked that language out with the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. I was assured by bond counsel and attorney for both the cities and the counties that there is case law defining substantial public interest in the context of local improvement district. I did a search of Oregon case law and could not find any such such cases. But I believe a substantial public interest would include something beyond an interest that would benefit solely the participants in the local improvement district. It would have to go, it would have to extend beyond that, and there would have to be something, some reason of change for changing the spread that would benefit either a large segment of the local jurisdiction or possibly the entire jurisdiction. To avoid a substantial inequity was also language requested by the Association of Oregon Counties, we were more than happy to put that language in for it.
So I'll ask them that question. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Further questions? Anderson Gardner.
Just one question. What's the need for the emergency clause in the bill?
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner, the purpose of the emergency clause for the bill has to do with Section 2 so that the ongoing case, this bill would apply to that ongoing case, and we could get an immediate ruling from the City Council, City of Tigard City Council, to adopt findings to show whether or not they can meet the test in subsection 2, Section 1, sub 2.
Chair, if I might, then you're not trying to predetermine the outcome, but yet you got an emergency clause, so they can do that so it can affect the case. That is somewhat predetermining the outcome, isn't it?
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner, we are not, the passage of this bill will not determine the outcome of that case. What it will do is require the city to go back and adopt additional findings to justify what they did in that particular circumstance. Because as the testimony was presented, and we have expert testimony to this effect, this is the only situation that we are aware of, or that our expert is aware of, where a local government has ever gone back after the fact. Total project costs will certainly increase. As the longer the project takes, the longer the total project costs increase, and we all understand that, and this bill doesn't affect that. But this is the only case that we're aware of where there's actually been a change, a shift in the percentage share of the total project cost that each participant in the LID is required to make.
Okay, just one more. One of your main complaints is that there's a retroactivity to what the city did in assessing the LID, is it not?
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner, one of my, what I believe what I said is what I find ironic is that one of the main complaints from the opposition to this bill is that it will be applied retroactively, when essentially that's exactly what happens to trigger the need for this bill. It's what happened previously, and it's what will happen in the future to trigger this bill.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair, because you said exactly the other way, that you didn't like the retroactivity of what they did, so you're doing something retroactive as well.
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner, I believe what I didn't like about what happened in that particular situation is that my folks were, when they originally participated in the LID, were led to believe that the total project costs were going to be $1.9 million, and their share of those total project costs were going to be 27%. When the project was completed, the total project cost went from $1.9 million to $4.6 million. And in 1998, my client's share all of a sudden went from 27% of the total project cost to 44% of the total project cost, followed up by a request that my client either Bancroft bond that $1.9 million in assessments, in other words, spread it out over a course of years, within 10 days, and in order to do that, my client had to waive its right to object to the shift in the total project cost, or alternatively, pay $1.9 million in 30 days with a guarantee, with a promise by the city that they would then foreclose on the property in 60 days if my client couldn't come up with that $1.9 million. That is unfair, and that's exactly what happened in this case. This bill would prevent a city in the future from doing that, and we don't think, if there's no objection to the language in Section 1 that it's good public policy, we don't know if it's good public policy in 1999 or 2000, why it wouldn't be good public policy in 1998.
I appreciate your able advocacy on that point, but it would also seem to me that way back when this particular property owner entered into that voluntary agreement, you may have thought that the terms were favorable under the terms of that agreement, and maybe he, just making this up, thought maybe his share would go down over time rather than up, but he ends up finding a situation where the city decides that the share is going up. I don't know this. I'm just saying we're going back and reconstructing. At least if the laws change for the future, everybody goes in knowing what the standards are for the future, but we're not changing the standards for the past. Were there maybe people, if we change it retroactively, would come back to us and say, hey, I went into this expecting that there'd be an adjustment because of whatever other factors. I mean, it cuts both ways.
Now, Chair Simmons, Representative Manick, I don't believe this happens. As I indicated earlier, our expert was the city planner in Gresham for 20 years indicated that he was unaware of this ever occurring. So I don't think we're talking about something that happens very frequently. I can guarantee you that in the situation that we're involved in now, my client certainly didn't have the expectation that the fees would go down. My client's a fairly savvy investor and property owner and understood that the total project costs may go up as the project took. Extended out, but my client wasn't aware that the city would have the ability to simply, at random, shift the method of assessment from one form to the other and increase his share of the total project cost. What was ironic in this particular situation, in 1998, at the time that the city of Tigard the city council actually adopted the difference method of assessment, which resulted in my client's share going from 27 to 44%. They also indicated on the record that the original method of assessment was also fair and equitable. Well, why are you essentially changing horses at the end of the race in that situation? But that's exactly what happened.
Okay, how would you react to removing sections 2 and 3 from the bill?
Chair Simmons, I think I can only answer that question by saying what I believe I said to both to Representative Manning and to Representative Gardner, and that is, if this is good public policy,
in the future.
It's darn well good public policy in 1998. And it was then, and it is now. If this bill passes with 2 and 3, it won't go back. And it won't necessarily result in a change in the outcome of that particular case. All we're asking the city to do with sections 2 and 3 is to go back and readopt public findings to show why there was a substantial public interest in forcing my client to pay an extra $750,000 in costs with a savings to Walmart and Costco of an equivalent amount.
Just one quick question. You said it won't necessarily affect the outcome, but it very well could, couldn't it?
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner, it very well could. If the city can't show that they had a substantial, there was a reason for making that change, then in my opinion, they shouldn't be able to make that change.
Mr.
But in terms of the answers to the question that you gave us a couple of minutes ago, actually, Section 2 is a very limited retroactivity provision. It's retroactive as to districts formed prior to January 1, 1985, which means anything formed from January 1985 to the effective date of this act doesn't get advantage of the new rules. Seems to me it was pretty carefully crafted to apply only to one case.
Chair Simmons, Representative Mannix, that's correct. If it had applied to a broader category of cases, we would not have had opposition from the AOC and the Legal Board of the City.
Final question? It seems to me that if the city was engaged in this kind of activity, one, that they'd have a lot of trouble in court based on what you said. Obviously, we're not here listening to both sides in the case. But two, that there ought to be some way of negotiating a resolution of this problem. Has that been explored?
Chair Simmons, Representative Mannix, we are in that process as we speak, but I don't believe there will be a resolution, a mediated outcome to this particular proceeding.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill, please? Come on up. You might hang tight here somewhere.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good evening. I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. Just want to say briefly that our concerns are indeed with the retroactivity aspect of the bill that appears to specifically affect Tigard. I have several cities that have contacted us with concerns that they had LIDs formed prior to 1985. They don't know that they had changed the methodology, but they're scrambling to go back and see, does this affect more than Tigard? I don't know the facts of the case in question, so I'm afraid I can't answer any of your questions regarding that. I know there have been several cases from the testimony that was presented to the Senate committee. The attorney for the city of Tigard presented information that there had been previous cases. This was one that continued to be pending. It would interpret current law, and in our opinion, the court should finish that interpretation. We do not have a problem with the bill going forward if it does not include the retroactivity. That is our primary concern. I was contacted by an investment banker who works with local government bonding, and the concern that was expressed that this makes financial markets nervous when there are these kinds of retroactive changes. It potentially affects the ability of local improvement districts to obtain funding, and those were the kinds of issues that were raised. So again, our concern is with the retroactivity.
Could you help me answer the question, what would avoid a substantial inequity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, as it was described to me, for example, if an LID had been formed and there was an expectation that there were 10 lots that were going to be affected, and it was found that one lot couldn't be built on, it would be substantially inequitable for that owner of the one lot to pay the same as everyone else because there had been a change in circumstances from the time it was found.
Do you want to respond to that? And is there a question?
Just briefly, Chair Simmons, again, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. One of the reasons that the language in Section 2 was drafted so narrowly was because of that very reason. We wanted to avoid requiring local jurisdictions around the state to check back and see whether or not they had LIDs that were formed prior to 1985 that were essentially potentially subject to this legislation. And understand that the method for challenging an LID is via what's called a writ of review. And the writ of review has to be filed within 60 days from the time that the LID, the LID decision is made, the final assessment is made. So in order for this to apply to any other LID in the state, you would have to have an LID that was 14 years old, or actually almost 15 years old at this point, that had still not been completed, and for which there was still a 60-day writ of review period applicable. There are no LIDs in the state of Oregon that are not completed that are 14 years old other than, or almost 15 years old other than this unique situation in the city of Tigard. And that's one of the things that makes this situation most frustrating for us, is that this LID was formed in 1984 and in 1999 it still is unresolved.
When was it formed?
1984. And it's still unresolved.
Any questions from the committee?
I didn't understand that question.
Is this a point of clarification for background as I put this together? Is that you had mentioned good policy from this day forward in the case that's prior to 1985. I just want to follow your logic as to why it would not be good policy between 85 and to the present.
I believe it would be good policy from 85 to the present. At the same time, that would also implicate a requirement from every local jurisdiction that they go back through their records and search to see if they had any active LIDs. Actually, it would apply to all active LIDs that were formed after January 1, 1985. And we didn't want local governments to have to go back to do that, essentially. That's a huge burden on local governments. In this particular case, however, the facts of this particular case are unique in that you have an LID project that extends beyond anybody's reasonable imagination of how long a project should take, coupled with a 17% shift in the total project cost. Outrageous, that something that nobody had ever imagined would happen.
Okay. Well, I think we better defer action until Sunday afternoon. Representative Starr is back with us. He went home for a birthday party this evening.
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1333. On the agenda here this evening, SJR 6 and Senate Bill 946. And 46 may not be needed depending upon the amendments that are before us. And there are a six amendments, so we'll send it easily. We pass out amendments. Order, and we will adjourn.
Thank you. 1 o'clock, Mr. Chair.